Warning, this episode contains details involving sexual abuse and may be disturbing to some listeners. Some names in this story have been redacted or changed to protect the privacy of those involved. There are also some details involving animal cruelty as well. Listener discretion is strongly advised. At the beginning of September, I received this email. Hi, Roseanne. I'm writing this email on behalf of my mother, name redacted, who asked me to approach you. I recently made the mistake of asking if she ever knew anyone who was murdered. She told me a very long, heart-wrenching story of her childhood. Things she buried in her mind years ago and now that I've resurfaced. She feels a lack of resolution to the story and wants someone to cover it. Honestly, as a true crime fan, I think it is a story worth telling. I'm sending this from my email, but the below message is hers. Feel free to reach out to me and I'd be happy to connect you. She's eager to share, but asked me to help be a filter. Remembering these events have left her a little raw. She says, I am a native Californian and have been an avid listener of your podcast for several years. I love how you bring compassion to devastating events and are able to present complex stories to your audience. That's why I'm writing to you. I'm part of a complex story that has touched many people and multiple generations through the actions of a man named Melvin Just. I'm related to him by marriage and related by a different marriage to many of his victims. He destroyed the lives of two wives, 12 children, and dozens of grandchildren. I witnessed his attempts to murder my grandmother, and he successfully murdered Josephine Spiegel and was never charged with the crime. Josephine Spiegel was working as a nurse/social worker in 1969 when she was raped and strangled with her own sweater and her dog's collar. Her body was dumped in the woods near Carlotta. While the murder made front page news in the Eureka Times Standard, and the local police ultimately called the FBI, the case technically remains unsolved. While Melvin Just did spend time in prison for sexually abusing his daughters and stepdaughters, he was never charged with killing Josephine Spiegel. The murder happened while Melvin was married to my maternal grandmother, name redacted. Although at that point, he was living with another woman and I'm going to call her V for the purposes of this story. The family was living in pretty extreme poverty, and there were allegations of abuse and neglect. On the day of the murder, Josephine had seen several other families, as noted by her records, and the last on her list to visit was Melvin Just's household. Her body was found the next day. The case was investigated, but it was never solved. Melvin did not hold a regular job, but he did mechanical work on cars. V, another garbage human, of course, she was an awful woman. I remember her looking much older than her actual age and always just looking greasy and dirty. She had the kind of voice that people get when they chain smoke cigarettes for decades. She protected him for years and years. I think she only admitted to knowing about the abuse after he got out of prison. I'm sure she would have known about the murder. I'm not sure how my grandmother met Melvin Just, other than it was a really impoverished area that they both ended up in. My grandmother moved out there with her four kids and a husband at some point, and then she and her husband divorced. Then she met Just in Washington and they married in 1957. I was about 8 living with my mom, the daughter of the woman married to Melvin Just. Within days of the body being found, the adults in my life were speaking in hushed tones. My mother was very vocal about his guilt in private, and the next few years passed with a lot of whispers and finger-pointing, but nobody was willing to help the police with their investigation. They were just too afraid of Melvin Just. My mom eventually married Melvin Just's second wife's ex-husband, and we'll call him Bob. And dreamers, that would be the ex-husband of V, Melvin's second wife. I know it's unbelievable. Bob's children with V would come over and visit us regularly. And when they were visiting, the children would complain about the sexual abuse that they experienced at the hands of Melvin Just. My mother witnessed the sexual abuse firsthand when she was a teenager in Melvin and my grandmother's household and urged the children to testify. Melvin was convicted of sexual abuse in 1978. At the time, my mother tried to get him charged with Josephine Spiegel's murder. She was instrumental in reopening the case, but the charges were never filed. Whether there wasn't enough evidence, or there was just no desire to prosecute at the time, I don't know. This was something I filed away as family history until a month ago when my adult daughter was visiting and we were talking about true crime. She asked if I knew anyone who was ever murdered, and I began to tell her this story. She hopped on Google to see if there had been any resolution to the case over the last 40 years. What she found was a documentary, Just Melvin, Just Evil, was produced by my cousin and was broadcast on HBO in 2000. While the documentary touches on the abuse and the murder, I found it was one-dimensional by someone who was not a witness to these events and did not interact with these people on a regular basis. My cousin only brought up things that were salacious, and I can't shake the feeling that he victimized the victims in his film. I was haunted by some of the things he let them say, and he chose not to edit out. I don't know everything Melvin Just did, but I know that his crimes and the terrible decisions of the people around him have never been fully examined. This case has not been reviewed by any book, TV show, or podcast, and there is so much left unsaid about it. I'm reaching out to you because I think you are the right person to share the story of Melvin Just and examine the impact he had on this small Northern California town and my family. I have photos and letters proving my relationship with Melvin Just and that I was living in the area, and at times I was also living in Melvin Just's household. If you choose to cover this case, I would be willing to share copies of these and answer any questions you have. However, I would like to remain anonymous, as research into this case will show this was an extremely dysfunctional and abusive household, and I am estranged from my living relatives and do not want to be found by them. Thank you for taking the time to read this. I edited out a number of details for brevity's sake in this email. The full story is complex and unbelievable, taking place over several decades. And that includes another murder Melvin Just may have committed long before the above-mentioned crimes. Thank you for your time. United States Army 2nd Lieutenant Josephine Barbara Spiegel was born in Buffalo, Nebraska on November 1, 1920 to parents John and Louise Spiegel and was the sixth of eight children. She was preceded in death by her father and three of them. Her second eldest sibling, Frederick, died at the age of 29 in 1941, and that was the same year her father passed away. She had an older brother, Henry, who died that it appears to be about the age of three, and because there was a sister born the same year as him, it leads me to believe that they were perhaps twins. Another younger sister named Helen died in 1951 at the age of 26. And as for the rest of Josephine's siblings, the eldest, Charles, he passed away in 1978 at the age of about 68. Third eldest, Wilhelm, died in 1994 at the age of 80. The fifth sibling, Marie, died in 2004 at the age of 88. And the eighth of the Spiegel children, Albert, passed away in 2009 at the age of 80. While there may be a number of Josephine's nieces and nephews out there somewhere, she herself never had any children of her own. And as of the week that I am writing this, Josephine would have turned exactly 100 years old. She was murdered on March 10, 1969 in Eureka, California, and she was laid to rest in Portland, Oregon. She was a veteran of World War II and the Korean War. At the time of her death, she was a nurse and a social worker. So I did ask several questions of the sender of the email, and I will get to those in a few moments. I'm going to want you listening to jot down any questions that come up as you are listening, so please grab a pen and a paper. I know I only asked a limited number of questions, and with your help, I would like to expand on that, and that would be greatly appreciated. before I get to my questions, I want to share the articles in the newspaper at the time about Josephine's case that were attached to the email that I received. The first one was from the Times Standard in Eureka, California, dated March 11, 1969. It read, "Buried in shallow grave, officers hunt brutal killer. An unknown killer, using his victim's sweater knotted by a stick, strangled Mrs. Josephine Spiegel in Eureka yesterday and buried her body in a shallow grave near Carlotta. The body of the almost nude Humboldt County public health nurse was discovered by Martin Johnson in Hammond's Grove while he was walking his dog through the woods, according to sheriff's deputies. Johnson said he saw her grave being guarded by a white poodle. The year-old miniature dog was Mrs. Spiegel's pet, Precious. Mrs. Elva Strutkis, a supervising nurse at the office where Mrs. Spiegel worked, positively identified her body at Goblay's Mortuary in Fortuna this morning. She said the woman was on her way to visit a patient in Bridgeville when she met with foul play. An All Points bulletin has gone out describing the 1967 tan Plymouth sedan driven by the murder victim, which was missing from the scene. Known by her co-workers as an outspoken and outgoing type of person, Mrs. Spiegel, a hazel-eyed, reddish blonde, lived alone at 1080 A Street. Described as about 50 years old, the sheriff's office said she was nude except for stockings and shoes when she was found at 5:30 p.m. Her clothes were pushed up in a bundle and buried with her. It was the description of her orange burlap skirt and orange sweater to fellow workers which struck their hearts with fear before positive identification was completed. It just had to be her, said one of the women, who was reportedly slain from 24 to 48 hours before. The next article in the Times Standard, dated March 15, 1969, reads as follows. Death clues checked out by deputies. The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office advises that the 1968 green Oldsmobile parked at Strong Station about 1 to 3 p.m. on the day of the murder of Josephine Spiegel, a Eureka public health nurse, has been found. The occupants were on legitimate business, deputies said. However, the Sheriff's Department is continuing its appeal for any information on a black or older model car with two male occupants, which was seen in the Cummings Creek or Fir Creek areas between 11 a.m. and 3:30 p.m. on Monday. Also sought are a tan-colored car, probably a 1967 or 1968 model, or a yellow or light brown Chevrolet El Camino. Both vehicles were seen in the same time period and vicinity as the black car. Sheriff's deputies continue to talk to persons calling in information, which may ultimately lead to the arrest of the slayer, who strangled the nurse following a savage beating and left her in a shallow grave at Hammond's Redwood Grove near Carlotta. And deputies hope for information received from the State Bureau of Criminal Identification and Investigation and the FBI in Washington, D.C. on fingerprints taken from the county pool car number 421, which Mrs. Spiegel was driving before she was slain, will lead to further knowledge of the murder. So, they didn't say in this article, but here we do know now that investigators did find Josephine's vehicle, which was presumably driven and abandoned by her killer. They lifted prints off of it, and I believe at the time nothing came of those prints. And I'll talk more about this later on. The third article in the Times Standard, dated March 17, 1969, reads as follows. Cars found in murder, all cleared. No substantial developments in the solution of the murder of County Public Health Nurse Josephine Spiegel in Redwood Grove near Carlotta a week ago today have occurred over the weekend, Sheriff Gene Cox stated here this morning. Cox canceled the public assistance call-in locating four vehicles reported seen in the area and whose occupants were sought for possible information on the case. All have been located and cleared, Cox stated. The Sheriff's Department is still waiting fingerprint classifications from the FBI laboratories in Washington, D.C. and the State Bureau of Criminal Investigation and Identification, he said. The prints were lifted from the county pool car which Mrs. Spiegel had been driving before she was slugged, raped, and strangled with her sweater and a dog chain. Cox said further materials are being shipped to the FBI today for analysis, but did not specify the items. The case right now is just at a standstill, Cox stated. And a fourth and final article mentioning Josephine in the Time Standard was dated April 9th, 1969, and reads as follows. Three killings still probed by officers. The violent deaths of three Eurekans and two slayings are still under investigation by city police and the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department. The bludgeon strangulation murder of public health nurse Josephine Spiegel, 45, in a Redwood Grace near Carlotta, March 10th, still has four sheriff's detectives attempting to piece together vague clues, and local police are still working on details of the deaths this week of Annie Sully, 62, and Aurelio Bernard, 33. And next to his age, there's a parenthesis with the number 83 and a question mark next to it. And it continued, found shot to death in a Third Street residence on Monday. Just a note about this article so far. These are written kind of awkwardly, and there are several mistakes that are likely not going to be made these days. Josephine was 48, and this article erroneously listed her age as 45. It was written that she was murdered and buried in a Redwood Grace, but it's meant to say Redwood Grove. And as for the second murder, whomever transcribed these articles noted that the second victim listed, Aurelio Bernard, his age is said to be 33, but in parentheses, like I told you, it said 38 with a question mark. I looked around online for anyone named Aurelio Bernard, and absolutely nothing came up. I also searched for Aurelio Bernard and Aurelio Bernhardt, and still nothing came up. So the age of this victim being 33, whether or not this is accurate, I could not confirm. The article continued. Results of paraffin tests, and the word paraffin was misspelled in this article too, but it is referring to residue testing. It says, results of paraffin tests of the woman's fingers are still pending. An old five-shot revolver was found lying next to her bosom with three shells fired while Bernard lay in another bed, shot in the head, covered with a blanket. Police, however, will not state that the case was definitely murder and suicide, since other theories are not beyond the realm of possibility. Hopes of an early solution to the Spiegel murder vanished when fingerprints lifted from the county car she had been driving were found to be insufficient for identification. Josephine Spiegel's murder eventually grew cold. Melvin Just died on July 31st, 2011 at the age of 71. And while he'd always been suspected by some to have been responsible for Josephine's death, I don't know the extent to which he was investigated, and he was never officially named a suspect. Whatever Just knew, any information that he may have had, that went to his grave with him. Josephine's murder remains unsolved to this day. I replied to the email that I received, and for purposes of this podcast, I'll refer to the sender as Dee Dee. The email had first come from her daughter, but I began corresponding directly with her. I said I would look into the case, and I eventually replied with a number of questions of my own. I'm going to go through the questions and answers that Dee Dee provided. And while I do, please don't forget to make note of any questions that you may have about this case so I can include those in a follow-up email after this goes live. And then I will follow that up with an addendum to this case, hopefully with some more answers. I also have not watched the documentary yet. I thought that maybe after we did this, I would give you listening a chance to watch it too. It'd be kind of a thing we could do together. Because it is on YouTube, it's for free. And I started to watch it, but I stopped because it did seem to be focusing heavily on the sexual abuse. It is a complex story, and Melvin Just is in this documentary too. I really want to know more about Josephine Spiegel first before I go back to it. So at the end of this episode, I'm probably going to assign you listening and myself the homework of watching that documentary. I'll remind you towards the end, and I'll make sure to post links. Now, on to my questions. The first one I asked Dee Dee was, before your daughter asked you if you knew anyone who had been murdered, when was the last time you thought about Josephine Spiegel or Melvin Just, or was it something that you buried in the recesses of your memories? And she replied, it is something that I don't think about. I pushed it way into the recess of my mind. In fact, this is something that I have never discussed with a close friend or even my husband of almost 33 years. Remembering about that time and answering questions now, I am reminded of the terror I felt in that household as a child. I always knew something was wrong. As an adult, I realized the adults knew too, and nobody could fix it. The only person I have talked to about any of these people was my mother, and that was almost 9 years ago. I confronted her about the decisions she made, and we have not spoken since. Next, I asked, did you ever meet Josephine? What do you know about her? I read in her obituary that she was involved in World War II and the Korean War. Do you have any other information about her that you can share? And Dee Dee replied, I was a child at the time, 7, when she was visiting the home. I don't recall meeting her, but she may have been at the home when I was there. It was like she was one of the ladies who brought the children holiday gifts. I didn't know much about her even after the murder. I just knew that the family had been assigned a social worker by the county. The adults never talked about her specifically until she was murdered. Next, I asked, how is it that Josephine came to be involved in working with Melvin Just's family? Did someone report suspicions of abuse going on, which prompted Josephine to be assigned to the case? Explain. Dee Dee replied, the county was involved before the allegations of sexual abuse, I believe. I'm not sure what initially triggered the involvement of the county other than the welfare of the children. V, Melvin's second wife, had been married and had 3 children, 2 boys and the youngest, a daughter, who was born disabled. Then she married a second time to Bob and had 5 more children. I don't believe she ever worked. She lived on welfare and limited child support. Next, I asked, what year was Melvin Just convicted? How many years did he spend in prison and where did he serve his time? Dee Dee replied, he was convicted in 1978 and he spent 8 years in prison in San Luis Obispo. At the time, my mom and her husband Bob and his eldest son with V lived in Washington State. Bob's daughter with V would come visit, as they did when we had lived in Sacramento before moving to Nevada and then Washington. My mom had been trying to get Just charged with these crimes for a couple of years at this point. She always told me that she was never abused, but a school friend of hers was assaulted by Just in the late 1950s when they lived in San Francisco. My mom's younger sister was also abused. Part of our estrangement is her putting me near this man and knowing he was abusing young children. Everyone knew about the abuse. The kids would talk about it openly in the family. There was some effort to protect V's daughters. Agencies were called. The girls were brought to the school office and questioned, but they denied the abuse. They knew at the end of the school day, they had to go back home and Just would be there. Part of his shtick was absolute cruelty, killing cats by tying their tails together and tossing them over a clothesline, putting puppies in a bag and tossing them into a pond. He was a very mean person. The threat of violence against anyone who said anything was always there. Melvin was finally brought to justice after Bob's middle daughter came for a visit. Being away for a couple of weeks gave her the strength to come forward. It was not an easy process, and the other girls were still in California and denying all the abuse. I credit the social workers and the change in years brought in how these issues were looked into. Bob's middle daughter never went back to California. And by the end of summer, all of Bob's children and Just and V's daughter came to live in Washington while the investigation and the court issues were being resolved. During the investigation, my mom attempted to get the authorities to look at the murder of Josephine Spiegel. However, at the time, the abuse case took precedence. None of the children were talking about the murder. The oldest girl, who in the documentary talked about the murder, would have been 5 years old at the time, and I'm not sure how much of what she claims to know has been embellished. During the investigation and before the children were in Washington, Just threatened to kill my mom and her family. My mom and her husband went into hiding, and I was placed in state care. Next, I asked, how long was Melvin just married to your grandmother? Who was he married to when Josephine was murdered? Dee Dee answered, Melvin married my grandmother in 1957. They finally divorced officially in 1972, but they had separated when Just beat my grandmother almost to death. Unfortunately, I witnessed this, which happened sometime in 1967 or 1968. After Just left my grandmother, he moved in with V. Josephine was murdered the following year while he was still legally married to my grandmother. I don't know if he ever married V. I don't know her maiden name. Her first husband was Don. Her second husband was Bob, who my mother eventually married. Her third husband would have been Just if they married. Marrying him, though, would have cut off state welfare services. I next asked, who is the other person Melvin Just is suspected of murdering? Do you have any information to share about that murder or any links to any news articles about that case? And Dee Dee replied, I do not have a name. This is a difficult one, and my daughter has looked but can't find anything about it online. Melvin Just grew up in the Seebeck area of Washington. The story I was told by my mother is that a young man was murdered in the area. He was found in the middle of the road. A car had hit him, thinking it was a sack thrown in the road, but it was a body. He was beaten to death and sexually mutilated. His penis was cut off and shoved into his mouth. I don't know why this crime was committed, only that Melvin Just was allegedly involved. I was told that this is the reason Melvin, my grandmother, and her children, my aunts and uncles, moved from Washington to California. This is a story I heard told several times as a child, sort of a family history that the adults talked about, and my mom did at some point share the name and more information about the murder. She would have been in her early teens around then, so maybe 13 or so. I would know more about this, but I haven't retained what she told me, and unfortunately, I'm estranged from my mother and won't reach out to her. I next asked, is there any evidence still in existence in Josephine's case? Is her clothing, the sweater, the dog collar, any swabs taken from her body? Has any of that been saved in storage? And if so, what law enforcement agency has it? And Dee Dee replied, I just don't know. The last time I knew about people actively looking in the case was in the 1970s. This area was rural, and impoverished is an understatement. I don't remember an active investigation. There were no resources in the community combined with people fearing Melvin Just. I believe it was an open secret that he helped himself to other people's things. People in the town knew something had happened before the body was ever found, and before the newspaper article was written. I remember the tension that something was going on. The adults were talking in very hushed voices about it. I next asked, what is the status of Josephine's case today? Is it a cold case? Has it been officially closed? If it is still considered open and unsolved, do you know, or would we be able to find out who the case has been assigned to? And Dee Dee replied, it is a cold case. The last I heard about it, it had not been closed. I do not know who would be assigned to it. Okay, so dreamers, I sent an email to the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department explaining who I was, that I received an email from a listener who wished to remain anonymous regarding the 1969 unsolved rape and murder of social worker Josephine Spiegel. I gave a brief background about Melvin Just, that he was a convicted sexual predator, and that he has long been suspected of being involved because Josephine was assigned to his case, and his was the last home that she was scheduled to visit that day that she died. I explained that Just was dead, is dead, and that we are interested in where the case stands today, who was in charge of her case, and if it had been investigated anytime recently, and if there was any evidence that could be tested for DNA, and if the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department isn't the correct agency to speak about this, please connect me with the right one. So I'm waiting for a reply. I will share my email with you a little bit later on in this episode. So next I asked, does Josephine have any living relatives that we know of? Did she ever have any children that you know of? I didn't see any listed in her obituary, and it appears that all of her siblings have passed away. And Didi answered, I think there are two nephews still alive, children of her brother Albert. I asked, I haven't watched the documentary yet. I was about to, but then I remembered, well, you wrote about it being salacious and you weren't too fond of the manner in which the story was presented. Should I watch it? Is Josephine's murder mentioned in it? And she answered, the murder is mentioned in there about 2/3 of the way in. One of the victims goes into a lot of detail of what she remembers, but I'm not sure how accurate her recollection is. She would have been 5 years old at the time, and the details she gives in the documentary don't match the known facts from the case or what the adults talked about my whole life growing up. It's my impression that she and the others in the documentary are adults who have been so abused and struggled with decades of alcohol and drug abuse as a result of it. She may have over-embellished the details. At one point, she mentions there being blood everywhere, but Josephine's body wasn't damaged in a way that would have left blood everywhere. Just time and trauma has led everyone to sort of the same sequence of events. When watching, it's important to remember that most of the people interviewed who said that they witnessed the murder would have been very young, between 2 and 5 years old. A few people in the documentary talk about how Josephine walked in on Melvin just raping them in the living room. However, that is not how it would likely have happened. That's not how this house was set up. He always took them in the back bedroom, behind the kitchen hallway, or into his room. It wouldn't have happened in the living room. This was a 4-bedroom, 1-bath house with 9 children, 2 adults, dogs, and dirty beyond imagination. I was not there the day of the alleged murder, but I spent enough time in that house. The front porch was covered in plywood and plastic panels full of old parts of cars and random salvaged items. The front door was never locked. It opened into the living room, which is why he took the girls to the back room. The story told to me is that Josephine showed up. She was there to check on the kids, sort of a normal routine, making her rounds. She would have gone inside and went into the kitchen. Whether one of the other children let her in and she discovered Melvin assaulting one of the kids, or if she made a threatening remark about an issue, she was cornered in the kitchen. I was told that she was pushed or grabbed and fell into the space between the stove and the counter. I remember talk of there being some evidence found there. Whether it was a piece of clothing or some blood, I don't know. I don't know if she was raped in the house, in her car, or where her body was found. I don't know if her car was ever found. I will point out that she arrived in a car and someone would have had to help Melvin get back after discarding her body and car. V, as I mentioned earlier, had 2 older boys. The oldest one would have been a teenager during this time. So I'm assuming what Dee Dee is saying here is that maybe one of them or V could have helped Melvin get back from dumping the body and the car. So it's possible that he had an accomplice. Okay, so Dee Dee here has some information about Josephine's car. As we read in the article in the paper about this case, her car was found and dusted for prints. It didn't specify where her car was found, though. But Dee Dee also did say, to her knowledge, that police never came and invested Melvin Just's house or the property. Dee Dee continued, this is a tangent to your question. I know, but I think it's worth knowing that when you go to watch the documentary, it's worth watching, if nothing else, because it might help you give a clearer sequence of events. There are so many people and so many years that the story took place over. But go in knowing that the murder is a small side story. It really is not given the time or attention that it should have been. And the women who claimed to have witnessed those events were very, very young and have struggled with drugs and alcohol for decades. Their memories conflict with the evidence and what I always heard growing up in the 70s when they were trying to get Melvin Just charged with murder. Next, I asked, what do you make of the connection that's been made between Melvin Just and the missing women of Humboldt? Do you think that there is a connection? Have you explored the theory? Perhaps Just was a serial killer, or Does the timeline add up to the time that Jess was living in the area? And Dreamers, the reason I ask this is because of a post on Web Sleuths. I will go over that after I'm done going over these answers to my questions here. And Dee Dee replied, I quickly thought not just a coincidence, however, now I'm not sure. He was a cruel man. He had opportunity and he was always scavenging for junk. I looked at a couple of women and the areas are within easy reach. The girl who went missing after visiting a friend at Humboldt College. My mom attended Humboldt College in 1969. When I was 18 months old, for some reason, my mother sent me to live with her mother and her husband, who was Melvin Just. The man she knew had abused her friend and younger sister. My mom said it was because I was ill and my grandmother was a nurse. However, she also had 3 children under the age of 7. The youngest was less than a year older than me. I don't remember living there. After I returned home, the next time I saw Just again, I was 7. Every time I was around him, I would wet myself. This was far outside normal behavior for me. Now I question what I don't remember. I next asked, has Melvin Just ever been convicted of anything in any other states that you know of? And Dee Dee answered, not that I know of. I next asked, has DNA ever been collected from Just by law enforcement that you know of? If so, is his DNA in the National Base of Criminal Offenders? And she answered, not that I know of. He does have a few living children, and several of them have been convicted of felonies, so I would expect that their DNA would be in the database. He has a son named Jack Just that is not mentioned anywhere in the documentary or anywhere online. Jack is 5 years older than me, so he would be around 65 years old if still alive. Watching the documentary will give you a view into the kind of damage this garbage human has sown. The absolute absence of male relatives in this documentary bothers me. Melvin's son Jack, Bob's son Brad, V's 2 older sons, and the movie producer's brother John. One of the more disturbing issues of the abuse is that Melvin had the boys participate. He would let them choose which sister to have intercourse with while he had sex with another of the girls in the same bed. My next question was, what did Melvin die of? And Dee Dee replied, I don't remember. It may be mentioned in the documentary. He was very obese. He was not mobile and he was pretty old when he died. I asked, whose idea was it to put Just Melvin on his headstone? I thought that that was quite fitting, because that's the title of the documentary, Just Melvin, Just Evil. And Dee Dee replied, I don't remember. I didn't even know he died until this summer. But his burial is featured in the documentary. You might wonder as to why the movie came out and I didn't know about it. Let me explain. At the time the movie was being filmed, we, my husband and daughter, were living about 30 minutes from my mother. She moved to rural Georgia to be close to her identical twin sister when I was 18. My husband took a job in Chattanooga, Tennessee. At the time, we were not estranged. However, her husband and his children were not welcome anywhere near my daughter. Without putting to paper the harm done to me, let's just say that more than one man should have gone to jail. But because there was no intercourse, my mom told me that what happened to me was not that bad. That he would not harm my daughter is why we are estranged. Unlike the daughters and stepdaughters of Melvin Just, I knew this was wrong after all my mom talked nonstop about Just and his nasty behavior, so I told people. I was removed from the home for a while. Police were involved and then we moved. After Just was put in prison, the children all came to live with my mom and her husband. I moved out at 16 to live with friends. Bob's middle daughter, Tina, claimed that Bob attempted to have sex with her. Shockingly, my mom was upset that Tina would make up a story for attention. Bob's oldest son, Brad, was caught having intercourse with the youngest daughter, Bobby. Within a couple of years, Denise ran off, Bobby ran away, and my mom and her husband drifted until settling in Georgia near her sister. I knew she was in Georgia, but I was not given an address for over 10 years. My mom said no one could know where they were because Melvin Just might harm her. But I'm not sure the real reason. I believe my mother kept me in the dark about the documentary because I would have exposed her and her husband. I love that the focus of your podcast will be the forgotten murder of Josephine. The rest of the information is to give a sense of the cast of characters. Melvin just was evil, but for evil to exist, good people have to do nothing. Thank you for taking the time to read all of this, even the parts that were written as much for my benefit as to help with the true story. One of the lines in the documentary that Ronnie repeats is that only he and his mother made it out. I realize he is wrong. I made it way out. I have a loving husband and a beautiful, very smart daughter, a lovely home in a very nice town. I finished high school. I went on to earn 2 college degrees, and I'm happy. Someday, I will let my daughter read this. However, right now, I want to keep some of this at arm's length. She is a bit worried that she's opened a Pandora's box. We were sitting by the pool this summer, and she was telling me about her podcast and asked me if I ever knew anyone who had been murdered. I took a deep breath and said yes. I went to high school with a girl who was kidnapped, sexually assaulted, and murdered. 2 men were caught and tried and sent to prison. A woman I worked with was murdered by her husband. He also went to prison. And then there was Josephine. So now, let me share the email that I sent to the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department. It read, I'm writing to see how we would go about finding out information about a cold case from 1969. I host a California crime podcast, and a listener emailed me about the murder of a social worker named Josephine Spiegel. She was 48. She was raped and murdered on March 10, 1969 in Eureka and buried in a shallow grave near Carlotta. There were a few articles about her in the local paper, the Times-Standard, but the case ended up growing cold. The listener was the step-granddaughter of a convicted child sexual abuser named Melvin Just. Just's family had been assigned to Josephine, I believe because of suspicions of abuse and neglect, and the last home visit she made the day she was murdered was his house. He had always been suspected of being involved. Some members of his family by marriage attempted to have him investigated further, but nothing ever came of it. He was eventually convicted of the sexual abuse in 1978 and served 8 years. He died in July of 2011, and whatever he knew about Josephine, he took that information with him to his grave. I asked the listener if she knew what law enforcement agency Josephine's case was assigned to, and if it was still open, or if it had been given to any cold case unit, and she did not know. So my question is, who would be in charge of Josephine's case today? I would like to get in touch with that agency to see if there was anybody who had been working on it or is planning to work on it, and if there is any information about the status of her case. This is a rape and strangulation with her own sweater and her dog's leash. I'm curious if the evidence in her case still exists and if it has been or is slated to be tested for DNA. The listener who reached out to me wishes to remain anonymous and is estranged from her family. I do not know her personally, but from what she has shared with me, this entire process is dredging up long buried and painful memories. Melvin Just victimized so many children in his family, his own as well as those whose mothers he married or was in relationships with. He paid the price for those crimes, though 8 years hardly measures up to all the lives he destroyed over several decades and generations. But the unsolved murder of Josephine Spiegel has haunted this listener for more than 50 years. She was 8 years old when the murder happened. The man she is convinced responsible for the murder is dead, but I get the feeling that if she knew where the case stood today, if there was any sort of possibility that one day Josephine's killer may be positively identified, that it would give her a measure of peace with it. If this is not the correct law enforcement agency to reach out to, I'd appreciate it if I could be pointed in the right direction. Thank you for your time. So I'm waiting on a reply with that. If any of you listening have any other ideas on how we might be able to get more information, or if anyone else wants to try and email the Humboldt Sheriff's Office, the email that I sent that to is hso@co.humboldt.ca.us. Maybe if they hear from several of us, it might spark someone's interest. I'll post that in the show notes too. hso@humboldt.ca.us. As for the post on Web Sleuths, it was written by a member named East Humboldt, and it is dated September 19th, 2019, in a forum called Serial Killers in the Emerald Triangle. And I don't think in all the episodes that I've ever done that I ever talked about the Emerald Triangle. Several podcasts have covered the missing and murdered women of Humboldt County, and because it is such a complex story and it is also unsolved, and it's been pretty extensively covered, I just haven't done it. But the Emerald Triangle, in case you don't know, is a section of Northern California that was given this name because it was the largest marijuana growing region in the United States. It covers three counties, Humboldt, Trinity, and Mendocino. Marijuana has been grown in the area since about the 1960s, starting long before the sale and distribution of it was legalized in 2016. I really don't know how much or how little growers struggled with the legalities of it prior to the legalization, but I get the feeling that it was sort of one of those things that may have kind of been overlooked, so to speak, because it was such a huge industry for the area. I've talked about previously the drug trade in South America and how the economy of the area relied heavily on drug cultivation. And that may have been the same thing, it probably is, in terms of what's going on in Northern California. Their economy relies heavily on marijuana growth. And you know, I'm from Southern California, not Northern, so it may as well be two different states. I am not familiar with the way of life and the culture of those who live and work in the area and how much the Emerald Triangle has had an impact on that. If anybody has any insight to share, please email me and I will include your personal anecdotes for the follow-up to this addendum. I would like to know more about the life and the culture surrounding this area and how it has impacted the community. Don't forget to email me questions that you have about Josephine's story that I can ask Dee Dee and that she could try to answer for us. Though, I guess this goes without saying, I don't really want to ask questions that are too personal or potentially painful to talk about. I will put my email address and the email address of the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office in the notes and on social media when this goes live so you can all reach out to me. And everything you send me will be included in the next follow-up episode to this. So back to the post on Web Sleuths, it read as follows. Melvin Just has alleged to have raped and murdered Josephine Spiegel, a social worker, around March 11, 1969, where his family lived in Carlotta, California, in southern Humboldt. While sensational, no charges were brought against Just. Ms. Spiegel's case remains unsolved and long forgotten. I've created the following timeline for Melvin Just. Born in Bremerton, Washington in 1929, he died in Seebeck, Washington in 1999. Just enlisted in the military in 1946. He served in the Korean War. He married in 1957 back home in Washington. Records from 1960 to 1970 place Just and his wife living in San Jose, where he worked as a mechanic, with the exception of the years 1962 and 1969. In 1972, he was granted a divorce in Humboldt County. There was a large gap of information until he was convicted in 1978 on 12 counts of child sexual abuse against various members of his family through the Humboldt County Court. He then served 8 years in San Luis Obispo. I estimate that he would have been active in the Humboldt County area with ties to San Jose via Highway 101 between the years 1969 and 1978. Based on the evidence in Josephine's case, his preferred method of operation is to strangle and rape his victim. This is, of course, assuming Melvin Just was the one who murdered Josephine. We don't know that to be a fact, just a note on that. In the documentary, Just's daughter alleges that he coerced Josephine into a wooded area. She was found partially buried off a forest road. From 1975 to 1976, There were a number of women found in the Humboldt area fitting that described method of operation. Those include Janet Lee Bowman, who was murdered on September 30th, 1975, Karen Frances Fisher, who was murdered January 18th, 1976, Sherry Lynn Smith, who was murdered May 2nd, 1976, which was likely attributed to John Annabelle, and Vicki Lynn Schneider, who was murdered July 2nd, 1976, and this was attributed to Henry Lee Lucas. I'm going to cut in here and say that I am not familiar with John Annabelle, so I looked him up. He is currently incarcerated, though he became eligible for parole this year in July of 2020. He confessed and was convicted of the 1998 murder of Deborah Sloan. And in a sad, ironic twist, Deborah's daughter, Rachel Sloan, was also murdered. Sometime in May of 2013, a burned body was found inside of a refrigerator that had been disposed of off of Highway 101, but she wasn't identified until more than 2 years later in late September of 2015, and that was because she wasn't reported missing until May of 2015. Rachel had struggled with substance abuse and some brushes with the law in the years leading up to her death, and her case, too, remains unsolved. So going back in time a little bit in terms of John Annabelle, he was suspected but never charged of the murder of a woman named Andrea La Darute. She was 21 and disappeared in 1980. Her remains were discovered on the grounds of what was then Annabelle's place of employment. As for Sherry Lynn Smith, she was 15 and disappeared in 1976. Her remains were found on the property where Annabelle resided. And like in Andrea's case, Annabelle was suspected but never charged. Those cases are technically unsolved as well. So the Web Sleuth post continued after he listed those four potential victims that the MOs were similar to the manner in which Josephine Spiegel was killed. In a news article regarding one of these women, the sheriff's office stated that they had received 35 reports of rape in 1976. It may have been multiple suspects that were active during this period, but as for John Annabelle, he should be credited for the women known to him. In these cases, Sherry Smith stands out. It's been speculated that Henry Lee Lucas gave evidence that was provided to him in an attempt to form a plea bargain. In Dreamers, just a note, Henry Lee Lucas, which many of us may be more familiar with than John Annabelle, he made claims that he killed over 100 women, though only 3 were confirmed to have been committed by him, but even 2 of those may have been questionable. So the murder of Vicki Lynn Schneider, while it says it's attributed to Henry Lee Lucas, it's because he supposedly led law enforcement to her crime scene and knew details of the crime that he should not have known. But like the original poster stated, it's been speculated that he was fed that information by law enforcement so they could solve the case and give Lucas a plea deal. The Web Sleuth post continued. I suspect Melvin Just because after 1976, the killing spree sharply declined and the poster is referring to the killing spree in the Emerald Triangle. In 1977, Just would have been locked in a custody dispute that would end in his incarceration. Of course, you know this is due to the sexual abuse that he inflicted on the children in his family. With no family to return to, Just would leave the state of California altogether and return to Washington to live out the remainder of his life. It seems that Josephine Spiegel will remain a cold case, but the question I would pose, if those rape reports for the 31 others still exist, are there suspects' descriptions? The Spiegel investigation mentions a vehicle. Maybe that's a start. So while I like where the author of this post is going in terms of possibly linking Melvin Just to the missing and murdered women of Humboldt County, that would, of course, take another fresh look at those cases using the latest in science and technology, which also can be applied in Josephine's case as well, which is the main focus of our look into this. I just don't know if Melvin Just's DNA has been entered into CODIS. And if they did, if they would do it now or if they would run a check on it now, I wonder if it would hit on several cold and unsolved cases, or possibly even if they could utilize the familial DNA if some of his blood relatives are in the system as well. Also, remember that I mentioned that fingerprints had been lifted from the car that Josephine was driving, but at the time that did not yield any information or provided any leads. Don't forget that Josephine was murdered in 1969, and Melvin Just did not enter the criminal justice system until 1968, so his prints may not have been in their files. Dee Dee said that her mom tried to get Just investigated for Josephine's murder when he was taken into custody on the child sexual abuse charges, but obviously nothing ever came of that. It could be because they didn't try or they didn't make the connection. If those fingerprints taken from Josephine's car still exist in evidence, and Melvin Just's fingerprints should still be on file from when he was arrested, there could be something there if those things could be compared today. I agree with Dee Dee, and I strongly believe that Melvin Just is responsible for Josephine's murder, and I believe that the motive was to prevent her from reporting his sexually deviant behavior with the children living in his home, and the rape of Josephine was a component of his sick and violent behavior. I have some doubts about Just being responsible for the unsolved murders in Humboldt County, because I believe him to be so disgustingly lazy. I think he preyed on children in his own home because they were vulnerable, convenient, easy to control, and he didn't have to go anywhere. If he killed Josephine, it was because he had to, because she either walked in on or figured out what he was doing with the children, or she was about to figure it out. It would have taken Melvin Just a great deal of effort to murder, transport, and conceal her body, and I don't get the feeling that he liked making a habit out of that. I suggested a similar thing about the serial killer dubbed the Grim Sleeper, Lonnie Franklin Jr., when I covered him last year. I opined that he wanted to kill women in a way that was most convenient for him, by picking them up in his car, by shooting them, and then pushing them out into alleyways. It was fast, easy, and lazy. I get those same vibes from Melvin Just and how he chose his victims. Just like Dee Dee had said, Melvin Just was a disgusting piece of human garbage. He was also a coward because he preyed on children, and that is the main reason why I would have some doubt about his involvement in murdering adult women on a regular basis. So like I mentioned earlier, I do have a homework assignment for everybody who has a time, including myself, and I will post a link to this documentary on the case. I want all of you to watch it if you can. It's called Just Melvin, Just Evil, and it's free on YouTube. I'm going to watch it also. I've seen about 7 minutes of it so far. And also, please don't forget to email me your questions or any feedback that you have about this episode. Or you can post your questions and comments on the Facebook discussion page, on Instagram, or on Twitter. I will be checking all the social media to include that in the follow-up episode to this. If you have the time, please send an email to the Humboldt County Sheriffs to see what information that you can find out about Josephine's case and if we're talking to the correct law enforcement agency. Those emails will be in the show notes, as well as a link to Web Sleuths and Josephine's Find a Grave page. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this, and I look forward to your thoughts and feedback and questions about the story. I want to say a big thank you to the young woman who reached out to me on behalf of her mom. I'm not sure if she's going to be listening to this or not. I know her mom wants to keep some distance between her and the story. But I also want to say thank you to you, Mom, for writing to me and answering my questions to the best of your ability. And I can tell you how happy it makes me that you are happy and that your life is one that this predator did not completely destroy. Thank you so much for listening. I am looking forward to hearing from all of you about this case. Until next time, sweet dreams.